as I should give credit for the background music. That is Stratosphere, local band. If you haven't seen them, they're pretty fucking cool. Anyway, House Demolition Alert. Urgent for immediate release from the International Solidarity Movement, otherwise known as the ISM. The Haitian refugee camp de La Chine. On Sunday, the 24th of November, Lia Zmane, a human rights lawyer, filed a lawsuit on behalf of the Mohamed Ikhlas family, the father of an 18-year-old suicide bomber, Ayat Ikhlas, and seven other families in the Israeli Supreme Court to challenge the imminent illegal demolition of their homes. Lia Zmane also filed a lawsuit in the Israeli Supreme Court on behalf of 14 other families that will also be directly affected if the Israeli occupation force demolishes the Ilkhas home. Currently, there is a restraint order issued by the Israeli Supreme Court that temporarily protects the family and home, but no decision yet that would prevent the demolition. Right now, there are seven internationals staying in the Ilkhas home who believe in justice, and that it is illegal and inhumane to demolish the homes of Palestinian civilians. These internationals have decided to put their bodies between the bulldozers and the Ilkhas home, and to non-violently intervene if these serious human rights violations. This is the third time that the IOF has come to the home armed with psychological warfare and terror tactics, threatening to demolish the home after a few hours. According to Israeli law, when a person is 18 years old, he or she is considered an autonomous adult, legally responsible for his or her own actions. Israel claims to be a democracy, while completely disregarding countless international laws. In this case, even Israeli law should make one ask why this family should pay for the actions of the 18-year-old woman and their family. Why? Tragically, the only answer is collective punishment. And more on a similar matter, a bit more general, Israeli occupation forces aggressively destroying the homes of Palestinian civilians. Dated November 24th, 2002, from the Palestine in the Media Center. The Israeli Occupation Forces, or IOF, have begun actively and rapidly demolishing the homes of family of suicide bombers throughout the occupied territories in the Gaza Strip. Why, you ask? I do not know. They're already dead. Five homes have been completely destroyed during the last 18 hours in Bethlehem, where the IOF officially announced its intention to stay until all the homes of suicide bombers are destroyed. The situation is not much better in other cities. Eight homes were demolished this week in Nablus, Gaza, and Jenin. The IOF cannot justify this barbaric destruction of civilians' homes by saying it is about security, as the bomber, i.e. the threat, is already dead or non-existent. No, this policy is without doubt about an eye for an eye, or more than an eye for an eye. One way or another. Yeah, teaching them a lesson, quote unquote, as one is.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3, it's the February 9th, 2003 edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Coming early to you this morning, actually this is going to be our regular time, 9:30 to 1. Stay with us.
My latch, 'cause I got a nice car and left through. There ain't gonna be no place left to. But it's alright, cause I got a nice car and troubles of my own, and I just ain't got the time. Somebody else will do it, I won't think about it, maybe it'll go away.
Radio's Bathrobes Piers Broadsides. I'm your host, Robert Norse, going to be with you until 1 o'clock today. As I mentioned before, we have a new time coming in early, which is not going to be permanent if somebody takes over this time spot. And feel free to give a call if you have your own morning program you'd like to put on. I'll be moving up to 10 o'clock. But until then, I'm going to try to sneak in an extra half hour in order to, say my piece, and I have always unable to kind of cram it into the time that I need to cram it into. Part of that is bad planning. Part of it is, gosh, so much information and so much going on. But we're going to be going till 1 o'clock today, and then at 5 o'clock today, for those who are interested, there's going to be a special meeting of the sympathizers of, supporters of, and the Citizens Police Review Board in Exile folks who are getting together at the Wired Wash Cafe. So invite you to come on down to that and check it out. Should be very interesting. Mark Halfmoon, the chair of the CPRB in Exile, or former chair of the CPRB, is going to be there. There's also going to be a Tuesday city council meeting where they will throw the final spadefuls of manure on the grave of the Citizens Police Review Board. They're going to be doing the second reading in the evening of the elimination of the law that justifies the Citizens Police Review Board. And that's 7 o'clock session. I'll be giving you the exact, or more of the exact, more of the approximate time later on as we proceed. I'm going to kind of check it out on the web as we go. Today I've got an interesting tape to rebroadcast to you, which is a KGO, I usually ugh when I hear KGO, but KGO tape about the Ed Rosenthal conviction, an interview with Ed Rosenthal and some discussion of his medical marijuana conviction, where he was barred from presenting a defense that pointed out he had been deputized, officially and legally deputized by the Oakland city council and authorities to be a marijuana cultivator for those with life-threatening illnesses that need medical marijuana, and that is legal under Proposition 215 in California. And as many of you already know, Ed was convicted by a federal jury, I guess about a week ago, who, because they didn't know about this, four to six of them had said that they would have voted not guilty had they gotten this information. And it's a very interesting interview. I'm going to be playing it for you shortly. I'm also trying to one-handedly get a hold of the latest news updates on Ed Rosenthal and what's been happening with him. He isn't going to be sentenced until June, so that's kind of on hold, and I doubt there's anything really immediate that's happening, but there's a really interesting question there with the Rosenthal case that comes home to us here in Santa Cruz even more sharply, because every day Ed at least has high-profile support, high-powered legal attorneys backing him. He had four attorneys, the city of Oakland behind him. What about Jane and John Doe here in Santa Cruz, who continue to be eaten up in the drug war machinery, the drug prohibition machinery in, I guess it's now Bob Lee's district attorney's office. Bob's an amiable enough guy. Some people were rooting and cheering as he beat out Kate Canlis. But has he changed his policies around the drug war? I'm not aware that he has. And I guess I'll be pursuing that in the weeks ahead, maybe trying to get interviews with him and with others in the DA's office to find out just what they intend to do to make Proposition 215 and, just generally to ratchet down the war against people, which is masquerading as a war on drug abuse. It's actually a war on human beings that, as Ed Rosenthal repeatedly points out, put 750,000 people, made 750,000 arrests for marijuana alone nationwide last year. That's a huge number of arrests. I think there are 50 to 100,000 people in jail, actually, for marijuana. He has stats like it's an 18th of the entire criminal justice budget. It's a huge expenditure, as we're seeing schools closed locally, and the national mania from Washington for the war against Iraq ratchets up. There has to be reaction from us locally to stop this criminal absurdity that's institutionalized. I mean, I'm a big fighter against the sleeping ban and laws that criminalize the homeless, and the drug war, of course, puts the homeless squarely on the front lines, but it's much broader than that. It goes after thousands of people. I don't have the stats here locally for how many people fall victim to the drug war, but it's a considerable number of people, and I think it's something like it's 30 to 50% of the people in jail are there on drug-related convictions or probation violations. Don't hold me to that figure, because I'm remembering it vaguely. It might actually be more. It might be less. And some of those are connected with if somebody actually engages in abusive behavior around drug use, that's something else. I'm no sympathizer to drunk drivers, and I'm no sympathizer to violent behavior. But I am definitely a sympathizer to the right of every individual to use whatever medications or recreational drugs he or she needs to use or wants to use, provided they're over the age of 21, without the government sticking its greasy fingers, I should say its malignant claws, into the situation. So I'm going to sort of just throw this tape on, and this is really, it begins sort of in midpoint, because my producer was only able to get a part of it, but the part of it that she did get was great. And I think you'll find it useful. Again, this is not KGO live. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz replaying a taped interview with Ed Rosenthal. So ignore the call-in numbers. Ignore the... I think the ads have pretty much been cut. So we have that, thank God, eliminated. But pay attention to what's said by the people, because I think it's really pertinent. And if you've had experiences in the local drug war, I want to hear about them. Give me a call at 427-3772, 427-FRSC. I'd like to have you share them with us. And also, this touches on the important issue of jury nullification or jury supremacy, where the jury, of course, has the right to say, regardless of what the judge tells them, not guilty. We don't have to follow what you have to say, Judge. We are the ultimate arbiters of whether an individual has to go to jail. And, of course, the judges and the prosecutors try to keep as much information from the jury as possible, such as the sentencing length, such as, their right to even make these kinds of decisions. A defense attorney is not allowed to say, you, under the law, have the right to make a decision which is your own conscience speaking, and not simply adding up the A's, B's, and C's of a vicious law that got passed many years ago and is held in place by political skullduggery and ignorance and bigotry and stupidity. The juries actually were the first groups to end slavery in Massachusetts. It happened before the legislature acted in the 1780s and 1790s. Juries refused to convict runaway slaves. They said runaway slaves in Massachusetts are, we ain't going to send them back to their masters. We aren't going to guarantee property rights for chattel slavery. And that was one of the reasons in that particular venue that slavery went down real early. Within 10 or 20 years, it was eliminated by legislative means at the state level. And, of course, the Civil War eliminated it at the federal level in the 13th Amendment. But it started in Massachusetts with jury nullification. And that's also what I think is really our only tool at the moment. Well, we have a number of tools, but certainly is a potent tool we can use here in Santa Cruz at the courthouse. And I would like to see a project, if people ever have the time or energy, setting up tables there and giving out jury nullification literature to all people coming in and out, not trying to tamper with juries. That's what the judges and the DAs will no doubt say to us. But we will say back to them, and I've done this before, we're not talking about any particular case. We're talking about the public's right to know of its right about the jury, about how it can make a decision to say not guilty, regardless of what the judge says, and not be held accountable for that decision in terms of a criminal sanction or penalty. So let's listen to KGO. Let's listen to Corral, who was, I guess, Sean Nix's sub a week ago. It was about a week ago, about 8 days ago, Saturday, I think, Saturday evening. And give us a call at 427-3772 if you have thoughts on this.
Several nervous conditions that I need it for, but I of course haven't used it since I was arrested in February.
Your health deteriorated since February, since you have not been able to use marijuana.
It's more difficult.
Can have doctors been able to quantify that? I mean, does that play into the?
No, it's not to the point where it's a medical condition. Mm. I mean. It's a medical condition, but it's not to the point where I'm willing to take other medicines, which are very debilitating.
So even now, like right now, today, tonight, you're not able to smoke marijuana?
No.
Do they drug test you or something?
I'd rather not go into that part of it. But it is to stay within the government guidelines, that's what they say.
Hmm.
Now, what happens next?
On Tuesday, there's a hearing as to whether I should be immediately placed in prison or whether I should be out on bail, which I am, a $200,000 bail, until...
What was that raised? Was that raised through donations or...
Well, it was a property bond.
Mm.
So
that's rough.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot. That's a whole lot of money. 200 grand for growing pot. I mean, this is just ridiculous. Now, they're making you sort of their point man for overriding the California Prop 215. Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, they basically want to use you as their scapegoat, and if they can get the convictions here, they want to continue and just get rid of Prop 215.
That's right. I think that right after my, that pretty soon we're going to be seeing invasions of many of the dispensaries, and as a result of that, we'll have people having to get their medicine on the street.
Where did you get your marijuana before you were able to get it legally? Or able to grow it yourself? I mean, have you always just grown it and used it yourself, or did you have to resort to using it to getting it like most people did beforehand, which is on the street?
Well, I was in a unique situation because I knew many people who were growers, and
so you were able.
I was able to obtain it without a problem. But that's not a situation that most people have.
No, it's not. I mean, I get letters all the time from people that know that Andrew was a member of the Buyers Club asking me for referrals.
Well,
When Richard Meyer...
Actually, you know, your listeners should know that if they go just on to the site canormal.org, mm-hmm. there's a list of all of the medical facilities.
And, of course, they have to have doctor's prescriptions to even get in the door.
That's right. One of the health cards, either the OCBC or the San Francisco health card would help.
When you hear Richard Meyer, a spokesperson for the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, come out and say to the Associated Press, there is no such thing as medical marijuana, how does that make you feel?
It's not how it makes me feel. It's what I know, which is that this guy is a liar, that he knows better than that. I mean, it's as simple as that. He's lying to the public.
What is he gaining?
And let me just tell you that I'm a member of the International Cannabinoid Research Society, and that's mostly scientists who are sponsored by the U.S. government, either through grants or working with the NIH or NIMH. And for the past 2 years, the most exciting work in cannabinoids has been as medicines. And they're doing trials on humans for MS, and they've already shown spectacular results using different cannabinoids.
What does the federal government gain by prosecuting you and overturning Prop 215 and keeping marijuana illegal? What do they gain?
You know, there's a big bureaucracy that depends on marijuana in order to stay employed, and those are the prohibitionists. Even though 80% of the population and 80% of the voters, 70%, this area about 75% of the voters are for medical marijuana, there are people who have a self-interest in seeing it stay illegal. And let me just say this. $15 billion a year is spent keeping marijuana illegal. The federal government alone has 20,000 people in jail, about a fifth of the entire federal prison population is in prison for marijuana. Costs $1 billion a year just to keep those people in prison.
How much did the state spend on keeping marijuana?
Between the federal government and the states, it costs about $15 billion a year.
Because you know we're hearing all about all these budget, you know, shortcomings and deficits
Now California itself doesn't have a large prison population in for marijuana. It doesn't, because we have Prop 36, we have decriminalization, you know, an ounce or less is just a ticket, and it saved California billions and billions of dollars since these laws were enacted.
What about the commercials? I know this is a little off topic, but you're a columnist for High Times and for other publications.
I don't write for High Times, I write for Cannabis Culture magazine.
Oh, okay, Cannabis Culture, I'm sorry.
Yes.
The New York, where was it? Some story I read, New York Times or something, had you read High Times. What about the commercials that now equate marijuana usage to terrorism?
I prefer the ones that, this year on the Super Bowl, I don't know if you watched it, but if you noticed, there were all these commercials for beer, and all of these commercials were guys picking up women, like adolescent or teenage dreams of picking up women. Mm-hmm. And then they go, oh, don't let your kids use marijuana. They might get pregnant. Excuse me?
Yeah, exactly. 8080810, 8080810 is the number. We have Ed Rosenthal on the line. He is the person that the feds have picked to be the point man. They want to send him to jail, and in doing so, they want to try to overturn something that we have voted for, that we have said we want, which is Prop 215, medical marijuana. We've been fighting this battle now for 7 years. 96, we voted for this. It's still not settled. The feds are coming in and saying, we don't care, California. We don't care. We don't care what we spend. We don't care who we hurt. We don't care what families we destroy. All we care about is that you've done something that we don't like. When we come back, I'm going to address Mr. Rosenthal if he thinks that this is something that the administration is driving, and if so, what we can do to perhaps change that attitude. 8080810 is the number. You're listening to the Sean Nix Program. I am Carell here on KGO News Talk 810.
Of course, you're listening to Free Radio.
I love the engineer says in my headphones.
This is recorded.
I know. KGO News Talk 810. I am Carell, filling in for Sean Nix. My voice may be gone, but my personality is still intact. 8080810, 8080810, or on the web at KGO.com. Sing it, Deborah Cox. All right, we're talking with Ed Rosenthal. Federal jury found him guilty of the, administration told them to. And before we go back to Mr. Rosenthal, I want to read some of the emails I'm getting. This one from Rick Steve. It says, good evening, Carell. The U.S. government standard railroading of Mr. Rosenthal went just as the government intended. The jury obediently set aside their common sense along with their constitutionally intended function. The AP quote, jury foreman Charles Sackett III sat outside court that jurors were following federal law in finding Rosenthal guilty, but he hoped the verdict would be overturned. Pardon if I gnash my teeth. I believe the founding fathers placed the right to a jury in the Bill of Rights specifically to avoid governmental tyranny the likes of this. The jury foreman hopes their verdict will be overturned, as stated on his way out of the federal building. Doesn't that indicate a fundamental problem? Abso-friggin-lutely. When you have the very jury saying, hey, you know what, we think this is wrong, well, they could have done something about it. We're going to talk more about that when we come back. I am Carell, 808-0810, 808-0810, or on the web at KGO.com. Now let's go to ABC News for a shuttle update. You are listening to KGO 8. Now they're telling me 10 seconds. Okay, go ahead and look me up on the web at www.kgo.com. When we come back, we'll be taking more of your calls and talking to Mr. Rosenthal here on KGO News Talk. Sean Nixon until 10 p.m. this evening. I'll be back tomorrow night, 7 to 10 as well, 8080810 or on the web. When you combine that with the word web, you get well, at www.kgo.com. On the line, we have Ed Rosenthal. He's at the center of a controversy, a court case that's ongoing. The feds are trying desperately to overturn California's initiative, an initiative which other states have, of course, gone on and passed. And now the feds are saying no. And Mr. Rosenthal, are you there with me?
Yes.
Do you find this odd in a Republican regime where the Republicans were always for states' rights, always saying it's the states, where we have states that are now saying, okay, as a state, we want this. And yet now the feds are stepping in and saying no. Why do you think they're attacking this with such fervor? Is it coming right from the top?
Yes, it is. I think that John Ashcroft is a person who's anchored in a different morality system than most of them.
Anchored in a different universe. The man won't even dance.
Correct. Well, how about this? If he watches a ballet, that's a sin.
Yeah. Well, depends on who's dancing.
But, the Republicans, first of all, I want to say that during the Clinton administration, the number of arrests for marijuana went up from about 400,000 a year to 750,000 a year.
Well, before you go further, let's go to Joe in Livermore because he wanted to address that same issue. Welcome to the Sean Nix program. You're on with Carell and Ed Rosenthal. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, good afternoon. Good evening.
Good evening.
Hi, Ed. My question was, I thought that probably because of the change in administration, obviously years ago when Clinton got elected to office, he did say that he had smoked some marijuana. But I think that, I know earlier in the show you said something about how many numbers or the statistics in regards to people who are arrested for marijuana, and that California has laws that, below 1 ounce, it's only a ticket. But I think that this attacks the moral issues. And, yeah, the state has passed this law allowing medicinal use of marijuana. And, again, the federal law doesn't allow it. What is your opinion on, how the Republicans have reacted versus maybe how the Clintons reacted? And the other question I have is, where are you going to come up with the $200K if you have to pay it? I personally think if you break the law, you should be held accountable. And I don't.
He wasn't breaking the law.
I'm sorry?
He wasn't breaking the law.
I wasn't breaking the law. I was appointed.
The law in California was such that the
federal law, you were breaking federal law.
I wasn't breaking the federal law, and this is the reason why.
Then dismissed.
I was appointed an officer of the city of Oakland.
It doesn't matter. It's federal law.
Excuse me, sir. I don't want to argue with you. Would you like to listen to what I have to say or not?
Hold on, Joe. Joe, hold on. Put him on hold. Put him on hold. Let Ed respond before he starts yelling at him.
I was appointed an officer of the city of Oakland specifically to overcome the difficulties or the inconsistency between Prop 215 and the federal law. And as a city of, as an officer of the city, I was specifically exempted from the federal laws in the same way that narcotics officers are exempted from the federal laws when they either buy or sell drugs. And that's all under the health and safety codes. It's Title 21, paragraph 885D, which specifically exempts state and city officers from the federal law.
Joe hung up. I was going to ask him why he's so angry. He seemed very angry. And, you know, I have to wonder, why would someone be angry at you for doing something which, A, the voters said was okay, and, B, something that you need? You know, we're not mad. Each year, more Vicodin is prescribed than could fill the Rose Bowl. Every single year. Every single year, more people die of drunk driving than anyone dies of marijuana. But
Excuse me, nobody dies from marijuana. There are no recorded deaths from the use of marijuana.
But we were talking about the Clinton administration. You were saying that arrest went up under
That's
the Clinton
right.
administration.
That's right, because he was placating the judicial, you know, the whole criminal justice system. About 7% of our entire criminal justice budget is spent busting and imprisoning marijuana users.
What does happen to you? I mean, is it a very real possibility? And if so, when would you be actually going to jail?
My sentencing is June 4th, but I do believe that I'll have a number of appeals in, so that would probably be postponed.
So you'll file appeals, and they'll postpone the sentencing date until those appeals are settled.
That's right.
How long could this process drag out for?
I don't know. I mean, it could drag out for a couple of years.
Let's go to Ed in San Jose. Welcome to the Sean Nix program. You're on with Carell. If you want to join us, it's 808-0810 or on the web at KGO.com. Welcome, Ed.
Hello, Carell. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Well, the problem is not Republican, is not Democrat. You have to look at the root of the problem. The problem is the economy. If you look at the medicinal marijuana compared to pharmaceutical is a big advocate of this judicial system. Doesn't matter what would happen. This gentleman, he would be convicted because hundreds of billions of dollars the pharmaceutical company make money out of the drug compared to like medicine marijuana. If somebody gets a regular cold, they pay like $10, they get the marijuana, they get well. Compare that one to $200 or $400 medicine they have to buy it, they have to purchase it.
So you're saying the drug companies, the large drug companies, put political pressure on
to keep
marijuana illegal.
Exactly. It's not Republican, it's not Democrat. They have to blame where the blame is supposed to be. We have to give a credit where it's supposed to be. This gentleman, he will be convicted. It doesn't matter what happens.
Mm-hmm.
The jury, they will convict him because that's supposed to be.
Yeah, but what's so ludicrous about this, and thank you for your call, what really just ticks me off, I mean, just makes my nipple ring stand straight up, is that several members of the jury said that this was wrong, that their verdict was wrong. And as a member of the jury, they have the right to stand up to the federal prosecutors and say, no, we are not going to, we don't care what the law says, we are not going to convict this person. This is a wrong verdict. Instead of coming out of the jury room and walking out in front of the court, and more than one juror did this, saying, oh, well, we don't agree with what we had to do, I almost said a bad word. Bull crap. You didn't have to do it. You did not have, and to all those jurors that did, I say shame on you. Shame on every single one of you.
I think the jurors feel worse today than I do.
They need to feel bad. Shame on them.
I have no remorse for what I did. I'll tell you what, I take responsibility for what I did, but I have no remorse for what I did, because what I did was help patients to be able to provide their own medicine. But the jury members, I think that now that they've seen the whole thing, I think that they do suffer remorse. And you know, actually, I feel sorry for them, because
they didn't do their job.
They were placed in such a position that they felt that they had to vote against their own conscience.
I feel sorry for them because they didn't do their job, and their job was to vote their conscience. And, you know, people say, oh, no, their job was to follow the law. Eartha Kitt once told me, if a law is unjust, it must be broken. That's, you know, when she was talking about not being able to drink after a white person in South Africa. So she passed around a champagne bottle at her concert with one glass and had blacks and white drink because she said, what are they going to do, arrest everyone in my audience? Shame on them. Emailer says, love your show. We're listening online here in Reno, Nevada. Wanted to say that I'm not a drug user, but I watched my roommate die from cancer. When the morphine continued to make her sick, marijuana was the only thing that she could use to help her pain. I come from a law enforcement family, and I wonder what these right-wing folks who are convicting Mr. Rosen would do if they or a loved one became terminally ill and the prescribed drugs made them so sick they couldn't use them.
You know, I want to say something about that jury. They weren't a right-wing jury. And they were really a conscientious jury. But the thing about it is that they were so intimidated by the judge, for one thing. And secondly, the so much information, you know, they talk about the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. This was half-truths, lies, and keep it out totally. And,
so is that what you said that your lawyers have some grounds for appeal. Do you know what those grounds are yet?
Well, there are so many grounds because we think that there were a lot of errors made throughout, and we think that the prosecutor overstepped his bounds both at jury level and at other levels. And I'm not really into that part of it, but they do feel very hopeful that, you know, that this will be looked at in appeals. And, you know, we had a number of motions before in the hearings, and those were based on the Ninth Amendment, that is, those rights of the people not enumerated in the Constitution remain with the people, the Tenth Amendment, which is states' rights, estoppel, which is that I was led to believe by the government of the city of Oakland that what I was doing was perfectly legal, and, you know, it was they knew about it.
Who arrested you? It was the feds that arrested you, right?
It was the feds. You know, at my hearing, Barbara Parker, who is the assistant city attorney, came to my defense and said that she knew that I was an officer of the city and that the city enacted these provisions just so I would, people like me would fall under 885D of the federal penal code.
Let's go to
Totally, you know, it's a Kafkaesque. It's just an insane kind of bureaucratic.
Well, it is insane. It's completely and totally insane. 8080810, 8080810. And first and foremost, I should go on record as saying not only do I support medicinal marijuana, but I am one of those people who also support the legalization of it. Completely legalize it, tax it, get rid of the deficit, control it. You know, make it a controlled substance. You know, what they call it a controlled substance now, but it's the most out-of-control substance that there is. There's no regulation on it. There's no nothing on it. I mean, it's completely out of control. How can they say it's a controlled substance?
You can't control something when you make it illegal. The only way that you can control something is when there's a civil regulation. And I'll tell you what, one of the reasons why the federal government went after me was because I was trying to get the city, both cities, San Francisco and Oakland, to develop some sort of a regulatory system so that the marijuana would be inspected. You know, our food gets inspected. Shouldn't the medicine get inspected?
Yeah, because when Andrew bought it, sometimes...
Standardization, and what I was trying to do was develop a standardization and an inspection system to make sure that people got clean medicine.
Because when Andrew bought it, sometimes they would tell him to nuke it for a minute because there could be bacteria, you know, all this other stuff. I'm like,
right.
Well, why can't you guys...
Yeah. Fungus on it, yeah.
Right, exactly. Let's go to Ocione. She is in San Fran... He or she, I can't tell, is in San Francisco. Welcome to the Sean Nix program. You're on with Carell and with Ed Rosenthal.
Thank you, Carell. Hi, Mr. Rosenthal.
Hello.
Good luck to you. I'm for you. Just a couple of quick things to your listeners and to anyone who is listening for purposes other than supporting your show. This government initially was prepared to be of the people, by the people, and for the people. That's what this government initially was set up for, to escape tyranny.
Well, not if the people go against what those in Washington think we shouldn't be doing.
Well, I'm afraid the people in Washington don't really care about the people anymore. And it's
no, of course
up
not.
To the people to start caring about themselves.
Well, look what happens when they do. They end up facing five-year prison sentences.
You know,
we're going to go to break real fast.
It's not just the people in Washington. I say that, you know, people have a personal responsibility. So, for instance, this prosecutor has a personal responsibility for what he did. And if he's in a drug war right now, and he's a drug warrior, he's a war criminal, because he's stopping people from getting their medicine. He's may be directly or indirectly causing people not only to suffer
but to die. Yes, 80.
This guy, you know, these people. At some point, you have to say, hey, these people are not just doing their job; they chose these jobs. He can quit his job, and he has to take responsibility for the kinds of suffering that he's causing.
I agree, and nowadays, if, you know, a mother wants to, let's say her daughter or son has AIDS, heaven forbid, and they don't want to give them the AZT or the cocktail, a court can force them to give them the drugs. And yet, meanwhile, the courts can also stop people from getting drugs they might need, all because we deem one illegal. 800-810-800-810 or on the web at KGO.com. I am Carl, filling in for Sean Nix. I've got Ed Rosenthal on the line. He's at the center of the controversy.
This is pre-recorded. Don't call in. And it's not KGO. It's Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Conspiracy and cultivation charges. Their root of the matter is they want to overturn Prop 215. The Republicans who say they're for states' rights are saying California has no right to make this legal, and they're going to do everything they can to overturn it. I am Carl. This is KGO News Talk 810.
When it's all over, please get up and leave.
Question.
Tell me how you feel about this. Try to control me, boy, you get dismissed.
Yeah.
Pay my own condo and I pay my own bills.
Mm-hmm.
Always 50-50 in relationships.
Yep.
The shoes on my feet.
We're jamming. Hey, it's Saturday night. Why not?
The rock, I'm rocking.
All right, KGO News Talk 810. I am Carell, filling in for Sean Nixon, having a damn good time doing it, too. 800-810. 800-810. I'll be here again tomorrow night as well. My voice will be even stronger then, so glad you could join me this evening on the web at KGO.com or on the phone line. Ed Rosenthal is with me. He's at the center of, yet, you know what? What the hell's wrong with us? I used to do a segment on my program called What the Hell Were You Thinking? And you know what, legislators, what the hell are you thinking? I mean, really, what the hell are you thinking? We the people, three simple words, we the people of the state of California have said we want this. And maybe people go, oh, Ed was growing too many, Ed was blah, 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 Ed. You know what, I don't care. What I care about is that this is not about Ed and his crime. Nothing going on in the courtroom right now has anything to do with Ed and his alleged crime. It has everything to do with political posturing, the administration sending their guns down here to say that we don't care what you voted for, we want it this way, we are against medicinal marijuana, and the rest of the country has to be, because we are the White House, we are the feds, and we are going to have it the way that we want it. Who's going to pay the price? Ed's going to pay the price by possibly going to jail. Who else is going to pay the price? People like my last caller who had blind from cancer and has to use marijuana. My late husband who had to use it for the drug cocktail. I'm getting email after email from people who had either loved ones or friends that had to use it. You know, these are the people who are going to pay the price. And do the prosecutors care about that? Screw no. Does John Ashcroft care about that? I hope there comes a day, and you all are going to just go, oh, Carell, don't hope that. But I hope there comes a day when John Ashcroft's loved ones need a drug that is either illegal or unobtainable because of some stupid regulation, and he has to watch them puke or suffer. Because that's exactly what him and his asinine rules are doing to people here in the state of California. Let's go to Angela on a cell phone in Concord. Welcome.
Seizure, was in a coma for 2 weeks, and then he died.
Well, you know what? You can get a bad burger from McDonald's or from Jack in the Box and die from Tilmaine or from E. coli.
Yeah,
because that,
yeah.
But, you know, so...
My boyfriend
Excuse me, ma'am. Excuse me?
Uh-huh.
Go on, Ed.
I don't accept your story.
You know, I'm not saying
you know what? I'll tell you why I don't accept your story. You're not giving us the full story. And I'll tell you why I don't accept it.
Well,
if that had happened,
ma'am. The point I'm making is, You can interrupt me all you want, ma'am.
Hold on, Ed, just a second, okay? Angela, you were saying your boyfriend,
My boyfriend has epilepsy. He smokes pot.
Okay.
Now, his doctor doesn't give it to him. No, he gets it from other sources.
Right.
But, you know, it does help. But what I'm saying is you have a disease and, you know, you have to watch where you get your stuff from.
So you're actually supporting places that would regulate it and make sure that it doesn't happen like your friend who got them. Exactly.
But you're
on the same side as Ed.
Who grow it for that reason, they have the best pot. They really do.
So you're on Ed's side, actually.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for your call.
About that drug?
Yes.
That I think that what her friend got was something that was contaminated with something.
Right. Ed, we got to go. We're going to follow your case very closely. Thank you for joining us. I am Carell. Coming up next, more of the Lacey Peterson case.
And that was the Carell KGO show of a week and a day ago with interviewee Ed Rosenthal, convicted of cultivating marijuana plants for actually use by people officially designated as in need by the Oakland city authorities, or at least certainly deputized by the Oakland City Council around that issue. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and call-in numbers are 427-3772. I have a couple calls likely to come in, one at least, but I also have been looking at an article on the Counterpunch website, which I'm going to be reading from and be happy to interrupt it for calls. It's called The Feds Versus Ed Rosenthal, A Guide to Being a Real Juror, by Clay S. Conrad. Again, you can get this by going to the www.counterpunch.com website. Government has a boundless appetite to inflict senseless pain on Americans in the guise of the war on drugs, even at the cost of degrading federalism and the needs and values of the American people. A recent case demonstrates this arrogance handily. Ed Rosenthal was a medical marijuana supplier who, in compliance with the California Compassionate Use Act, had been growing marijuana for seriously ill people under a doctor's advice and care. Rosenthal was arrested in February 2002 and accused of supplying marijuana to the Harm Reduction Center in San Francisco. Rosenthal had been deputized by the city of Oakland, California, and made the official supplier of a city-sponsored medical marijuana dispensary. The Compassionate Use Act passed with 78% of the vote in San Francisco. It took a total of 80 jurors to find 12 willing to convict Rosenthal. Most of those summoned for jury duty said they would not be willing to brand someone a felon for growing or distributing medical marijuana. Even after eliminating those who would not convict in a medical marijuana case, Judge Charles Breyer did his best to keep any mention of medical use from entering the case. The jury was given no information as to why Rosenthal was growing marijuana. Rosenthal was disingenuously portrayed not as a conscientious caregiver, but as a large-scale drug dealer. The evidence that Rosenthal was growing marijuana was indisputable, although there were questions concerning quantities. The government charged him with growing over 1,000 plants, an offense potentially carrying a life sentence. In the end, the jury found Rosenthal guilty of growing between 100 and 1,000 plants. He now faces a maximum sentence of only 40 years without parole. For Rosenthal, aged 58 and with a 12-year-old daughter, the reduced sentencing range is a distinction without a difference. In response to the verdict, Drug Enforcement Administration spokesman Richard Meyer was ecstatic. "We feel the people of California have spoken. We're pleased with the verdict. Unfortunately, the only people that spoke were those allowed to speak, and 85% of the people had been eliminated from the jury. Even those hand-picked jurors were unhappy with the outcome. Several, including jury foreman Charles Sackett, apologized to Rosenthal and expressed shock and outrage after learning Judge Breyer blocked them from hearing Rosenthal's side of the story. At least half of the jury expressed their remorse and denounced their verdict. Several jurors held a press conference February 4, 2003, and complained of being misled, manipulated, and bullied into convicting in a case that none of them would have voted guilty in had they known the full story. The conscience of the community has been stifled." Sackett has said it is probable that the jury would have nullified the law and acquitted had they known this was a medical marijuana case and had they understood the independent role of American juries. I think jury nullification is going to be part of the answer regarding states' rights in future cases, said Sackett. Several of Rosenthal's jurors felt intimidated into going along with the verdict because they erroneously believed that had they engaged in jury nullification, they could have been punished or removed from the jury. Matt Gonzalez, president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, has commented, the jury should know of their ability to refuse to enforce federal laws when application of those laws would be unjust. The judge is not giving the jury any space whatsoever to engage in what has been an extremely long tradition in common law as it relates to jury nullification. San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi noted that jury nullification is a constitutional right that every individual person who is called for jury duty possesses, and unless we appreciate that right, we will lose it because the courts will take it from us. It appears that the Rosenthal jury failed to appreciate their nullification prerogative, and as a result have inflicted enormous and undeserved pain on Edward Rosenthal and his family. Mr. Meyer is partially right. The people of California have spoken. They spoke in passing Proposition 215, allowing for the compassionate use of marijuana by medical patients under a doctor's supervision. Under our federalist system of government, it would appear that the voice of the people of California should be heeded. Edward Rosenthal is simply a pawn. Having been caught in the crossfire between the DEA's insatiable desire to inflict pain on those who use or grow marijuana, regardless of the reasons and the compassionate tolerance of Californians. This is an article by Clay Conrad on the Counterpunch website, and now we're actually going to get to the meat of it, which has to do with doing your best as a trial juror, surviving voir dire. And we're going to do a little bit of this, and then we'll take a musical break and continue with the article. And if you want to call in and talk about this issue, if you've been on a jury, if you have been subjected to the drug prohibition war locally, or you have friends who have, please call and tell us your experiences. And again, consider this project that I propose periodically of tabling at the courthouse and giving out jury nullification literature specifically as it relates to the drug prohibition war, because I think that is the major juggernaut that is eating up everybody's liberties, eating up the county and state expenses, and just, well, eating up the judicial time. Here's the story. Doing your best as a trial juror, surviving voir dire. There should be no happier day in the life of a marijuana activist than the day he opens her mail and finds a summons for jury duty. While she may not be called to serve on a marijuana case or even a drug case, the number of such cases clogging our courts make it very likely. The opportunity to serve on a jury is an important attribute of citizenship and should not be wasted. It is the job of juries to ensure our courts dispense justice, and justice is what good activism is all about. What's a juror to do? How can jurors dispense justice when the law they are instructed to apply is unjust? The answer is simple: by voting their conscience. In every criminal case, jurors have a prerogative to acquit, whatever the evidence. And when they do acquit, the government cannot retry the accused or appeal the conviction. The case is over. The accused has been vindicated by a jury of his peers. When a jury acquits because the law is unconscionable, it is called jury nullification of the law, or in short, jury nullification. Jury nullification occurs in 3-4% of all criminal trials. Jurors cannot be ordered to convict or punished for acquitting. A jury verdict of not guilty is final. An abbreviated history of jury nullification. Jury independence is well established in American law. In 1804, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase was impeached for denying a jury's right to judge law. He holds the dubious distinction of being the only Supreme Court justice ever impeached. Why did the founders give juries such awesome power? Theophilus Parsons, first Chief Justice of Massachusetts, explained, "The people themselves have it in their power to resist usurpation without an appeal to arms. An act of usurpation is not obligatory, it is not law, and any man may be justified in his resistance. Let him be considered a criminal by the general government, yet only his fellow citizens can convict him. They are his jury, and if they pronounce him innocent, not all the powers of Congress can hurt him, and innocent they certainly will pronounce him if the supposed law he resisted was an act of usurpation." Or, as Patrick Henry put it, "Why do we love this trial by jury? Because it prevents the hand of oppression from cutting you off. This gives me comfort, that as long as I have existence, my neighbors will protect me." American history is full of proud examples of jury nullification. The common law tradition of freedom of religion and assembly has its origins in the 1670 trial of William Penn, accused of preaching an illegal religion in Grace Church Street, London. That was Quakerism. The jury refused to convict Penn, in spite of clear evidence of guilt, because they were unwilling to brand a man a felon for worshiping God according to his own beliefs. When the court attempted to punish Penn's jury for their act of nullification, a higher court reversed on the principle that it's only the jury, not the judge, which has the authority to decide whether a defendant is guilty. The American tradition of freedom of the press began in 1735 when a New York jury acquitted John Peter Zenger of seditious libel for publishing criticisms of the royally appointed governor of New York. Even though 18th century law didn't recognize truth as a defense to seditious libel, the rule was the greater the truth, the greater the libel, Zenger's jury acquitted because Mr. Zenger's words were true. But jury nullification of the law is not just a remnant of colonial days when Americans were still proud, independent, and free. During the 19th century, juries as far south as Georgia refused to convict whites who assisted slaves escaping from bondage. Escaped slaves were not entitled to trial by jury. A judge deciding whether to return an escaped slave to bondage was paid twice as much for finding the accused was a slave than for finding he was free. The inability of the South to see the fugitive slave law enforced led to the Civil War and thus the end of chattel slavery. As many as 60% of alcohol prohibition cases ended in acquittal, leading to the repeal of prohibition. Remember that under alcohol prohibition, possession and use of alcohol was legal. Only sales, distribution, and manufacturing was banned. A little subversion. The conventional wisdom is that jury nullification is subversive. Is that not the great American paradox, that our best citizens are our greatest subversives? A good American is by nature an inquisitive soul, unwilling and temperamentally unable to kowtow to malevolent authority, in short, an old-fashioned boat rocker. The Reverend Martin Luther King was investigated by the FBI. Sometimes a bit of subversion is needed to rescue government from itself. The second part of the credo, my country right or wrong, is when right, to stand by her, when wrong, to set her right again. Setting government right again is what jury nullification is all about. Bureaucrats may whine about subversion, but jury nullification in the end is the democratic response of deliberating citizens to laws that are not properly supported in a nation where we, the people, not the government, are the source of sovereign power. Judges refuse to tell jurors about their option to veto unjust or misapplied laws and may even dismiss potential jurors who let the court know they are aware of this power. That is why potential jurors must know their power prior to going to court. Most people who receive a jury summons do not show up for jury duty or try to get excused. If those who know about the power of the jury and who care about justice are willing to serve, their influence is magnified many times over. Surviving jury selection. In order to nullify the law, you need to survive jury selection. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Your radio is working, and we're reading from a selection by Clay Conrad on the Counterpunch website, How to Survive Jury Selection and the Whole Issue of Jury Nullification. In order to nullify the law, you need to survive jury selection or voir dire and be seated on the jury. When you appear for jury duty, you are a veneer member. The veneer is the group or panel of citizens from which a jury is chosen. The jury is chosen by removing the members of the veneer. Looks like we have an incoming call here. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
There's still that echo in the back. It's really difficult to talk with that echo.
I'm sorry about that. Let's see here. Let me quickly see if we can do something about that. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, great. Better. But still there, just so you know.
Okay.
There's a major shift, and I'm not saying anything that people don't know, a major shift politically that's, I think you could say it's a 40-year shift. Some of the things that are happening now would have been unthinkable 40 years ago when there was a major redistribution of wealth going on, where government intervention in redistributing wealth through taxation primarily was an accepted procedure. Over the course of four decades, those processes have played themselves out. And we're at the point now where people will look the other way at virtually anything the government does short of knocking on your own door. And I think the situation here with Prop 215 is quite relevant to that case.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that old, but my goodness, in the 70s, the late 70s, there was legitimate attempts to decriminalize the softer drugs, and that didn't last too long. Maybe what it is that some of the bureaucracies, the government bureaucracies, fear that their funding justifications are going to be dried up.
Definitely. What about this suggestion by Clay Conrad about jury nullification? Have you been on a jury yourself, caller?
No. Jury nullification, I think it's a good thing. It takes courage, and I think in the final analysis, if the jury system has merit in its full practicality, then the jury has the right to nullify the accusation. If the accusation is unmerited, like possession of marijuana. Well, if you're on a jury and someone's being charged with possession of marijuana, I think in honesty you can say, well, I don't believe that the charges have legal merit.
Even though it's the law. Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but are there not some precedences along this line?
Well, I mean, the precedents, actually, which I've been reading, have to do with the right of the jury to simply look at a case, any particular case, and any law. And they don't actually nullify the whole law. They just nullify the law's application in that particular case. And they can do it because they think the prosecution is malicious, because they feel there are particular hardship circumstances, because they feel the law itself sucks. For numerous reasons, they can nullify. And apparently, according to Clay Conrad, and I think it's true because I've read it elsewhere, they have nullified 3 to 4% of the time. I don't know about that figure, but that's an interesting figure. I'm curious, in Santa Cruz, how frequently people nullify.
Well, you can de facto nullify by saying not guilty.
Right.
Yeah.
One juror, and this is very important, who says not guilty, forces a new jury trial if the prosecution wants to do it again. And this happened, for example, in my case back in 1989, when I was convicted, the jury hung on whether to convict me for occupying the River Street mini shelter. We were trying to get this building, which should have been open to homeless people. It was purchased with homeless monies. It was supposedly for use, and it was the middle of winter, and homeless people needed it. But it was being stalled by the bureaucrats, and so we sat in there. They arrested all of us, and we created so much embarrassment that they opened the building 6 months early, and we actually accomplished our objective. It was one of those times when we actually were successful, which was great. But in order to punish us, they took us to trial, and the jury hung, meaning one or more jurors said we can't agree on a verdict, or are we there was, if there's a difference of 11 say one way and one says another, that's still a hung jury, whether it's for guilty or whether it's for innocent. So if you stand firm on a jury, you can stop the medical marijuana, you can stop the harassment of medical marijuana people, you can stop the harassment of people using recreational marijuana, you can stop the harassment of people who are using hard drugs if you don't think that's an appropriate response to this whole situation. But in order to do that, you have to be cautious and know how to proceed, or else you'll be intimidated and sort of tripped up by the judge and the prosecutor, who seems to be their main function is fucking people over in the drug war. I got to say that, because that's really what it is.
This guy, Mr. Rosenthal, at least the way it appears to me, has been hung out to dry.
Yep.
And those that are trying to rally behind his cause, you know, God bless them, but they tend to be their fringe. And they have become fringe.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you got Tom Ammiano, you got Terrence Hallinan, the district attorney. Tom Ammiano is the chair of the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. Matt, what is his name, the head of the Public Defender's Office. I mean, no.
Well, that's Sam corrected that.
In Rosenthal's case, they aren't fringe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to find anybody other than prosecutors and some really hardline fringe right-wingers and some government employees, the federal government, who support this stuff.
Well, Hallinan has a track record of being rather, quote, I hate to use the term, but progressive.
Oh, yeah.
About some of these things.
And he appeared at my hearing in 1996 when I was being sentenced for serving free food to the homeless.
Yeah, you played that on the air. many years ago.
And he said, you know, don't convict this. I mean, actually, I've been convicted. And he said, we don't want this guy sentenced. It should, you know, he's done a good service. And the out-of-town judge said, sorry, we're sending him to jail. So, but Hallinan has, you know, stood up on a number of issues ranging from, well, there's some controversy about decriminalization of prostitution, but insofar as prostitutes are being sent to jail, that obviously is a victimization of the women involved.
Would you say that medical marijuana is in fact, I heard Andrea Tischler on your show talk about medical marijuana,
mm-hmm.
and I think a lot of people probably agree with his perspective that medical marijuana was an interesting device to raise the issue, but it may have, in the long run, done more damage than good.
There's some controversy about that. I know Kate Wells thinks that medical marijuana has been very successful in many ways, although there are those like, I think Theodora, I'm not sure what Theodora thinks on this, actually, Theodora.
Well, I had a very early on, whatever you want to call it, pot card, but I opted to not retain it. I didn't want to get a doctor's excuse to blow a joint.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I rarely smoke pot anyhow anymore, but just the idea of having to claim that I got spasms or something because I want to get loaded just doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
All right? I mean, I'm not denying that pot has medical validity, but the fact of the matter is that there's no legitimate, honest, sincere reason why you shouldn't be able to blow a joint at home
correct.
In your spare time without fear of cops knocking on your door, okay? But be that as it may, there seems to be this sliding away of some of these issues that seem to have gained such significant momentum not too long ago.
Big time. Rent control, you know, the right of people to assemble in public spaces like the downtown ordinances.
I think there's, you know, I'm going to come
police.
Back to this shift. There's like this 40-year shift. I don't believe the hippie movement would have happened, and I'm not saying I know what I'm talking about exactly. I'm just going to give you my point of view. Without the redistribution of wealth that made the 60s, possible, made Haight-Ashbury possible, it made low rents possible. There were funds of the Great Society. There were all kinds of funds going around. There were grant programs left and right for the arts, for poverty programs. These kinds of things appear unthinkable today. We're in a period now where people don't want to be taxed for anything other than their own self-interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think actually the redistribution really began in the 30s and 40s, and that's where the major shifts took place. And by the time we got to the 60s, there was all being redistributed into the Vietnam War, and, you know, it essentially spelled the doom of a lot of these programs. But I'm going to try to get back to the issue of how do we in Santa Cruz stop the drug war? I mean, we actually began some of the movement for Proposition 215. We passed it here 3 years before the state did.
One of the things that Tischler said, that I agree with. I mean, there are people that are closet pot smokers because they don't want to be busted, number one, and it tends to be better for economics to, you know, not announce these things. But, you know, those of us that are in our 50s and 60s, maybe there's a point and there's a way that we can become public and show people that you're not necessarily a bank robber doper,
mm-hmm.
Because you indulge in marijuana on occasion. I think that we get hysterical about this stuff. I think a lot of it, Robert, is fear, and people, and the cops and the police state, if you will, has been successful in confusing the issue. Hemp is classic along this line. Hemp has been so confused by the DEA and by politicians looking the other way, that people that we've obliterated it from our history successfully.
Yeah, you even see it. You see the kind of confusion here at the local level, where even medical marijuana is largely criminalized, thanks to city ordinances that zone it out as of the 2000 law at City Council. And I guess Andrea Tischler and Kate Wells and Theodora Carey and other marijuana activists have said we need new laws at the city level that don't just protect Valerie Corral's WHAM, but that protect all the clubs, even all the medical marijuana clubs. And I would go further and agree with you. We need to decriminalize the use of marijuana locally. I mean, the people like Jerry Rubin in the 60s, as you know, when he ran for mayor of Berkeley, was urging, and I guess they actually passed in 79, making marijuana, not medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, the lowest priority. I got to go.
Let me just say one last thing. I think
mm-hmm.
what happens, as a general rule, is that as, and I even use myself as an example, that some of the good idealistic, sincere politics after many, many years, and one getting older, and you begin to need your own health care, and your own economic problems become important and become a priority, you let these things slip away. And I see this happening across the board here in
Stanford. New generation has to carry
on. You really have a handful of activists that are left, and Andrea Tischler is fairly well off, if my understanding is correct. I don't know if Kate Wells has any economic...
No, she's not doing too well. In fact, we're going to hear from her later on the show.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what happens. I think people fall by the wayside because they're afraid to jeopardize their economics. And at a certain point, you've only got so many years left to get your economic
Indeed.
Act together.
It could well be. We're going to cut you by the wayside. You take care of yourself.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. And phone number is 427-3772. I'm reading from Clay Conrad's suggestion on how to get on a jury, stay on a jury, and make sure that some justice is done instead of this incredible tyranny by writ that we have both throughout the Santa Cruz courthouses, courtrooms, and the federal courtrooms and so forth. I'm particularly concerned about it locally. I mean, he's talking about Ed Rosenthal's conviction. I'm talking about Santa Cruz and what's going to be happening Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday next week at the courthouse. In order to nullify the law, you need to survive jury selection or voir dire and be seated on the jury. When you appear for jury duty, you are a veneer member. The veneer is the group or panel of citizens from which a jury is chosen. The jury is chosen by removing members of the veneer. After both sides have removed the veneer members they object to, the first 12, or 6 or 8, depending on the case and the state, veneer members remaining are sworn in as the jury. Veneer members can be removed in two ways. They can be stricken for cause or through use of a peremptory strike. Both sides can remove as many veneer members for cause as they can find lawful reasons to strike. A for-cause strike is based on a veneer member being illegally ineligible to serve because, for example, he or she has a felony record, is not a citizen, is insane, or most importantly, has indicated that they are unable or unwilling to apply the law. Peremptory strikes can be used by either side for any reason other than race or gender. Depending on the case and the jurisdiction, each side may have 3 to 15 peremptory strikes, even more in death penalty cases. Generally, parties strike veneer members they believe are unlikely to vote for their side. The prosecutor and the defense attorney get to question veneer members about their attitudes, opinions, and behaviors in order to intelligently exercise peremptory challenges. Though I got to say, a lot of that has been taken over by the judges in California and the local courts, unfortunately. What this means is that if you show up for jury duty and proudly announce that, quote, marijuana should be legal, prohibition is immoral and unconstitutional, and I would never vote to convict anyone in a weed case, you will immediately be removed by the prosecutor for a cause, and you will have absolutely no impact on the outcome of the case. Similarly, if you say police do not arrest innocent people, the defense will strike you. You must appear neutral and fair to both sides to be seated. If you appear to lean too far either way, the other side will strike you off the jury. Thus, to survive jury selection, you want to appear neutral. However, you may not lie during voir dire. Lying can constitute perjury or obstruction of justice, felony offenses. The clue to survival is to give neutral but truthful answers. This can take some care and serious thought depending on the exact questions you are asked. However, there are some general rules. One of them is that you should never elaborate on your answers to voir dire questions or volunteer answers to questions that have not been asked. A typical question is to ask veneer members what organizations they are members of. In anticipation of this question, you may consider resigning from NORML, National Organization for the Reform of the Marijuana Laws, FIJA, Fully Informed Jury Association, which has to do with jury nullification, and similar organizations when you get your jury summons. You can always rejoin them later. Other typical questions and appropriate, unobjectionable, neutral answers include, what magazines and newspapers do you subscribe to or read regularly? Time to cancel some subscriptions, at least temporarily, and time to start reading Popular Mechanics, PC World, Money and People. Don't mention U.S. News and World Report or The Economist. People interested in world events tend to be opinionated independent thinkers. You want to appear a neutral, law-abiding, middle-of-the-road taxpayer. Do you know anyone with a drug problem? Yes, but not well. This is usually true because such people never allow themselves to know them well. Of course, if your spouse, parent, or child is in rehab, it's time to fess up. How do you feel about people accused of selling or possessing drugs? They deserve fair trials like anyone accused of a crime. Do you know anyone who's been accused of selling drugs? If so, the answer may be yes, but not well. If they ask for an example, they will stop after one, so there must be someone you know distantly who is accused of selling drugs. If you know someone who is acquitted on drug charges, say so. It lets the veneer know false accusations happen. Answer in short, to the point sentences and do not digress, volunteer, or elaborate. How do you feel about the government's use of paid informants or informants who are receiving reduced sentences in return for their testimony? Your answer should be their testimony has to be examined carefully but fairly. You have any strong have such strong feelings about drug cases that you would be unable to give a fair and impartial trial? Of course not. What you want is a fair and just outcome. If asked whether you are opposed to the drug laws, you can truthfully say you have questions about how effective drug laws are. Who doesn't? Even General McCaffrey has had such questions. If asked if you are able to put aside your opinions and vote guilty, you should always say yes. You can also say you are also able to shove your arm down a kitchen garbage disposal. That does not mean you are committed to doing so. Take the questions literally and answer as briefly and generally as you truthfully can, appearing for jury duty. Come into court looking like a respectable, law-abiding, middle-class American. Think of a perfectly acceptable computer technician visiting a DEA office. Wear clean, business casual clothes. Cover any tattoos and remove superfluous jewelry or piercings. Carry such work-related reading material such as a technical manual, a trite, apolitical, not classic novel, or a non-issue magazine such as People or the U.S., not The Progressive or Counterpunch or Mother Jones. Don't act like you are excited to be there. Nobody is happy to receive a jury summons unless they are either, one, retired and bored to death, two, insane, or three, have an agenda. If you are insane, you are not qualified to serve. You probably can't fake being of retirement age. Any excitement will be seen as an agenda. Act bored and a smidgen annoyed, but you must waste your time on a case that you could not care less about. Get a haircut. Do not argue that getting your dreadlocks cut infringes on your personal expression. The author of this article used to be able to sit on his hair, too. Getting a haircut may give you a chance to express yourself in the jury room where it counts. Hair grows back. A term in prison leaves permanent scars. Let us hope nobody reading this is so vain that their hairstyle is more important to them than the freedom of one of their brothers or sisters. When all else fails. Jury selection is not the time for speeches. Generally, the less you say, the more likely you are to get on the jury. The only time to proselytize during voir dire is when you know you will not be on the jury. The prosecutor has recognized you from a drug law debate or a demo, and he asks a question you just cannot truthfully answer without giving your position away. Then speak quickly in calm, rational sound bites. I could not convict a young man for a harmless act. It would ruin the rest of his life. That's immoral. Then sit down and be quiet. Make the prosecutor or defense attorney follow up by asking you more questions. Don't rant. If they ask a follow-up question, give a similarly short, to-the-point answer. The more polite, respectful, and reasonable you are, the more you will influence and perhaps empower remaining veneer members. What you must avoid is having the judge cut you off before your message gets out. You want to appear candid and honest, not like you are trying to send a forbidden message or to, as the courts consider it, contaminate other people on the veneer. If the judge blows up after you politely sit down, he risks looking like a tyrant. After all, if citizens cannot speak their mind, why ask them questions? That would be a fair question to ask a judge who would ridicule or chastise a veneer member in front of the rest of the veneer in the jury room. Once on the jury, do not mention nullification during deliberation unless the not guilty votes are in the majority. If the judge believes a juror is nullifying, he may remove her, causing a mistrial or allowing the remaining jurors to decide the case. First, however, the judge must question the juror. If the juror has doubts on the facts, she cannot be dismissed. If she justifies her not guilty vote by saying, "I cannot convict a young man for smoking a joint," she's gone. If she says, "I think Officer Krupke lied," the judge will return her to deliberations. The inability to discuss nullification openly encourages hung juries. If you must, hang. Reasonable people may disagree. You have a right to hang. You do not have a right to compromise someone else's life away. Vote your conscience even if other jurors browbeat you. Your principles are at stake. Principles cannot be compromised, only abandoned. Vote your conscience. Hang with pride. Just say no. I know of a case in which a prosecutor was offering a 20-year sentence as a plea bargain in a methamphetamine case. The defendant rejected the offer and took the case to trial. A marijuana activist was on the jury and refused to convict. The jury hung 11-1. When the case came back, the prosecutor reduced the charge to a misdemeanor with a 4-month sentence. The defendant is free today and with no felony conviction because one independent American stuck to his principles and followed Nancy Reagan's sage advice. Just say no. That is the power of a juror. American juries have a proud and heroic tradition of standing up to tyranny and saying no to oppression, to oppressive, unjust, or misapplied laws. Now, with the horror of the war on marijuana becoming apparent to a broad cross-section of society, we have an opportunity to make prosecution of marijuana laws an exercise in futility. Only when the likelihood of convicting and sentencing harmless pot smokers becomes minimal will our opponents begin to rethink their positions. We know what happens when they begin that process. They join our side. A jury summons is not just another form letter from a government clerk. It is an invaluable gift from our founding fathers, a gift intended to keep our government true, not just to the letter of the Constitution, but to its principles. Justice, our forefathers knew, requires eternal vigilance. Vigilance takes more than reading the papers and casting a ballot at election time. It requires that government be subject to continuous oversight by its subjects. Trial by jury was meant to ensure that citizens maintained a peaceful but powerful and effective means to exercise that vigilance, regulating, monitoring, and when necessary, vetoing tyrannical government actions. Decades of attempts by judges, prosecutors, and legislators to weaken trial by jury have limited but not removed the ability of juries to perform their intended task by keeping jurors ignorant of their nullification prerogative. Jurors, however, still have the same powers they possessed in 1776, if they only knew about them. Too many harmless people have suffered at the relentless hands of the drug warriors. Jury service is our best chance to fight back, and once we do, our victory, while slow, will be assured. And that's by Clay S. Conrad. He's the author of Jury Nullification, The Evolution of a Doctrine. He's a shareholder in the law firm of Lamson & Looney PC in Houston, Texas. He's the chairman of the Fully Informed Jury Association, and he can be reached at Weaselaw, W-E-A-S-E Law, one word, small letters, Weaselaw, at AOL.com. And you can reread this article, if you'd like, on the Counterpunch website. And the Counterpunch website is www.counterpunch, and that's small letters, .com. Give it a try. Lots of interesting stuff, including stuff on Iraq that I think is very pertinent. Very thorough series of articles that goes into an analysis, a counter-analysis of Powell's presentation last Wednesday. And we have an incoming call. Hi there. You're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. Listen, I just came in a little while ago. You were in the midst of reading that article, which is very good, as you point out. There's one thing, however, that I didn't hear, and maybe you read it in the earlier part, but it seems key. When the author says that you have to be careful not to lie, of course, that's true. However, the question that I'm, as far as I'm aware, the question that's most often asked, which is, it's a little difficult to see how not to lie about it, is will you set aside your own personal beliefs, your conscience, in some form they express that in obedience to the judge's instructions on the law.
Well, what?
And they ask that. As far as I'm aware, they ask that at nearly every trial, and it seems to me that anybody who is sincerely interested in making a change simply has to bite the bullet that they're going to have to say.
Caller, that was brought up in the article, and actually, it could be phrased the way you put it, or it could be phrased, can you set aside your prejudices and so forth, or your own convictions about the law and your personal feelings?
I don't think they say can you, because I don't believe that's the wording. I think it's fairly obvious what to do in that case.
Have you been to a jury selection recently? Have you been to a jury selection recently?
I haven't. No, I haven't been recently, but
I was at one about three or four years ago.
I've had a number of friends, and we've discussed this matter because it's absolutely key.
Yeah, I think you can find your. I can think.
You know,
I think you can find
doing
your,
anything.
I think you can
and
find
it
your
seems
way.
To me that you just have to.
Caller, I think you can find your way.
If you want to be on that jury at that trial, that one question you have to be.
I
able
think
to
you
say,
can. I think you can find your way around this by actually answering another question. In other words, when they say, will you set aside? You say, I think I can set aside my prejudices. You don't say you will. You say, I think I can set aside. And he would sound, he or she, the prosecutor, would sound pedantic.
Okay, well, that's okay.
Yeah, that's my suggestion. If they ask you
that
question, you shift the ground slightly, and you say,
intelligent way to do it,
I think I can set aside my prejudices, surely. You know, and I can give a fair verdict. I'm not, you know, and you can.
Uh-huh.
The question is, will you? Well, we'll see. You know, so that would be my thought on that, yeah. Any other thoughts?
Well, no, I just think that one thing that's was this mentioned at all, that the California Supreme Court recently ruled that anyone who in the jury room, that it is the foreman of the jury must report anyone in the jury room who proposes to do anything contrary to the judge's instructions, and that person will then be excused, and maybe probably a mistrial.
Wow, no,
excused.
I hadn't heard that.
May in fact be under charges of perjury.
I hadn't heard that.
That was I remember that was a couple of years ago. I think in 2001 there was a California Supreme Court decision that I could look up, but
no. I'd like to see that. Maybe you can look it up.
Sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Look it up and email it to me. I'd like to see it. You know?
Well, I'm not good on email, but maybe
give me a call.
Have a fax machine, Robert? Anywhere?
No, but if you leave a message on my answering machine, I can look it up if you just give me the case and the reference.
Okay. Well, I know, because at that point I kind of threw in the towel.
I got you.
But it is true that they can apparently, they're making every effort to do the impossible, which is to pursue you into the jury room.
Well, the answer in the jury room is you simply say you're just not convinced. You don't have to tell them your reasons. You can just keep saying, I'm not convinced. I mean, you have to hold firm. If you're holding firm against a hanging jury, I should say against a convicting or a jury that wants to find a guilty verdict, you have to, in essence, you don't say, I don't believe in convicting people of medical marijuana.
Oh, no, no.
Not convinced that all the evidence, I'm not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. And you don't have to give more reasons to other jurors. I mean, that's, you have a right to your independent opinion. You simply do. So if what you say is true, and it could well be that they're pursuing you into the jury room, then you have to be more prudent when you're in the jury room. You have to kind of come to the trial prepared, and if you're taken onto the jury, go into the jury room prepared.
Uh-huh.
I appreciate the call.
No, that's very powerful. I think that's good.
It's hard
good
to do.
Robert, I'll see if I can find that case for you.
And I expect to see you on the next jury.
Well, I've tried everything to get out of there. In fact, the one ironic thing was that I was called for jury duty on the one time that I was out of town and couldn't get back here. I was living up in St. Helena for a couple of for several months, and I got a jury notice to be on jury trial.
They come every couple years, so maybe you'll get one again. Thank you for calling.
Okay, thank you. Bye bye.
And phone lines are open again, 423-4833 at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm going to try to shift to another subject now, although you can stick with the subject if you'd like. I'm going to actually go to a local attorney. We're ringing here, hopefully. And I'm going to follow a case we've been following a bit called the Pinto case. This is a Watsonville man who was shot by a deputy. And let's see if we've got attorney Kate Wells. Oh, looks like we're going to have to try that one again. Try one more time. It's a very interesting case, and Kate Wells has talked about it on the air before, and we will catch her, hopefully, now.
Ellis.
Kate Wells, you're live on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I'm sorry to interfere with your Sunday, but it's always good to snatch you onto the air.
Okay.
Did you read the story in yesterday's paper by Kathy Redfern about the Pinto case?
Yeah, I surely did.
What I'd like to do is read it briefly. It's not very long, and then have you comment on it.
Okay.
The story reads, "Man shot by deputy gets prison for resisting arrest," by Kathy Redfern.